This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone. Happy Wednesday afternoon, and welcome to another edition of the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, I'm Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, and I'm very happy to have you along with me for the next hour. And you are listening to the show, as you always do, live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you are tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show, and you're doing that on our HRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest has saddled 212 winners thus far in his career. There will be many more to come, no doubt about that. But none have been bigger than the victory he tallied on New Year's Day when Capo Kane, the talented son of Kentucky Derby winner Street Sense, rolled to a six-length win in the $150,000 Jerome at Aqueduct. That race, by the way, is part of the Road to the Kentucky Derby series and was worth 10 points to the winner, moving Capo Kane into the eighth position in the Derby points rankings, which means if the Kentucky Derby was run today, Capo Kane would be in. And that is, in itself, welcome news to my guest on today's show, trainer Harry Weiner. And Harry, congratulations, first of all, on that big win, and welcome to Trainer Talk, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
All right, so that is your first stakes win. It comes in, well, with the 1,679th horse that you have saddled in your career. It's been a long time coming. Had to feel amazing, Harry.
Oh, it felt excellent. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's something I'll never forget, and hopefully there's many more.
Well, I'm sure there will be. Take me back to the moment when he turns for home and starts to pull away.
When he turned for home, and I saw Dylan look over his right shoulder, I knew he still had plenty of horse. And when he started pulling away, I just started screaming. It was just unbelievable. I got goosebumps all over my body.
How about when he crosses the finish line and you realize, oh, my gosh, we just did this?
Yeah, I started screaming so loud they could hear me at the starting gate that said on the other side of the racetrack.
Isn't that what this game is all about, though, Harry? I mean, look, forget about the number of horses you saddled prior to this. And winning, I've said this for many years, winning a claiming race, a maiden claimer, it doesn't matter. You win a horse race, it's a special thing. And that feeling is indescribable, really, for people that have never experienced it. But to win a race like the Jerome with a horse that you know is this talented, is that a little bit of a different level?
Yeah, I mean, every horse, when I win a race, I'm excited. But, you know, but to win a race of that magnitude and the way he did it, it's something exceptional. It's just a feeling that I'll never be able, you know, hopefully I can describe again.
You said that you thought he would run well, but you didn't necessarily expect him to win by more than six lengths and as easily as he did. What surprised you most about that performance?
The thing that surprised me most was the way he did it. He broke sharp and just the way how much horse Dylan had and the horse's ears was up. He wasn't even really trying very hard. He just did it all on his own. And when he pulled away, it was just unbelievable, I know. I thought the horse would be really competitive in there. There was a couple of real nice horses in there. But he just showed himself that day, and he just pulled away real easy.
It's only his third career start, so he's still learning. He's still developing. You're kind of a coach. You're still teaching him how to do what he's supposed to do when he gets to the racetrack. But he's now 2 for 3. He's won his last two starts. what were you seeing coming into the Jerome after his maiden win that made you think, okay, he's going to run well today?
Just the way he was training in the morning. He's galloping. I saw his, we call what a light bulb went on in his head in the morning. Every time a horse came to me, he just pinned those ears and just wanted to be in front of that horse. So then I knew the competitive inside him came out, and like I said, the light bulb went on. He just got stronger as he galloped.
You are a former jockey, and we'll talk more about that as we make our way through the show here today. But you get on your own horses in the morning. You get a feel for what's going on underneath you. What was it that you were feeling underneath you with Capo Kane?
I was just feeling sheer strength and his stride. I mean, he has such a long stride and he does everything so easy. And I was just feeling how strong he was. Before, he was a little laid back. We had to kind of push him along a little bit. And then from his maiden race to this last race, he just jumped on a bit and just wanted to go the whole time. Just got very strong.
You mentioned that long stride. As the distances continue to get longer, making your way down the road to the first Saturday in May, does that long stride, is that something, Harry, that's a benefit for horses when they stretch out?
Yeah, most definitely. It makes it easier on them, and you don't have to push them as hard. He can just do it on his own and sit comfortably.
The one thing, if people were going to look at this horse and say, maybe the question mark is the fact that in both of his wins, his last two races, he kind of tended to drift a little bit in the stretch. And you said in a quote after the race, that's only him being a little bit green at this point. Tell people what that means.
Being a little green, just like when Dylan switched to his left-hand stick, and the same with Lapida when he switched to his left-hand stick turning for home. In his maiden win and his last race, he kind of shied away from the stick. Just when you flag a horse or hit him left-handed, he felt it and he just kind of wanted to get away from it. But as soon as he switched back to his right-hand stick, he straightened right up again. So it's just greenness. It's just something that he has to learn and we have to teach him in the morning.
How do you do that?
Well, in the morning when you just carry a stick in your left hand when you gallop him and just show it to him, and he'll get used to that, you know. And then, and when you breeze him, give him a couple of taps left-handed coming down the lane, and he's just got to feel it and just get used to it.
Really, it's that simple. Just showing him a stick and letting him know that it's there is something that it's kind of muscle memory for him.
Yeah, on some horses, you know, we could always put blinkers on. I mean, blinkers do help so they don't see that. But obviously off a win, you can't change equipment, so we're going to have to go over options that we have.
Talking with trainer Harry Weiner here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton, fresh off that huge win, his first stakes win of his career in the Jerome. He is on the Derby trail with Capo Kane, the son of Street Sense, and no doubt the waters will get deeper as he moves along that road to Louisville. We are still some, let's see, Harry, 115 days away from the first Saturday in May. How much would you say you have Derby fever at this point?
Oh, I mean, a lot, you know. I just hope everything goes well, and you know, it's my job to keep him sound and keep him fit, and hopefully get him to the prep races that we need to get to for him to learn and everything, and get the points we need.
This has been a long journey for you. You were born in England, rode steeplechase horses. Again, we'll talk about that part of your story. You came to the U.S. in 1989 with trainer Michael Dickinson. I'll let you talk about him for a little bit too. But when you think about everything you've been through, to have a horse like this, what Harry, what does that mean when you think about everything that you've accomplished so far in your journey?
It just means I've come a long way from when I started. It's just an unbelievable thing, and I feel very blessed, and my owners have stuck by me, and we've been through hard times, and now we're going through the good times.
Do you even allow yourself to think 115 days ahead and think about what it might be like if he were to somehow cross the finish line first beneath the Twin Spires?
I really don't want to think that far ahead. I kind of want to take one race at a time, and then hopefully get there.
With
so
no
what's
injury.
Next for him? Where will we see him again, do you think?
The next race is going to be the Withers on February the 6th. I think it's going to be a good test for him. It seems to be at the mile and an eighth, and I think that's going to really suit him, and we'll get a better idea from there.
I think it's important to note, Harry, when you think about the success you've had, not just with Capo Kane, certainly, but that one, you know, front and center right now, but this is a horse that you purchased at the Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic 2-year-old in training sale for just $26,000, which is really looking like you have a keen eye, and this is a shrewd purchase right now. But this is not the first talented runner that you purchased out of that Mid-Atlantic 2-year-old in training sale. You did it last year with New York Traffic, and you started his career too before transferring to Safi Joseph down in Florida. What is it about the way you go about picking out these horses that's just worked all of a sudden?
Well, I like to go for horses with some size to them and some bone. I always believe if they have big bone, they hold up better. And I like to go with some size and where they can grow into themselves. And that's it, really. And I look for, you know, the correction, make sure they're straight, and the altitude on them.
What do you remember about the first time you laid eyes on Capo Kane?
Just the size of him. He's a monster. He had a big neck on him, big shoulder, nice round rear end. And I knew he had some growing to do. And just his attitude, it was just like, look at me. I'm the man.
We hear that a lot, where trainers will talk about a horse having that look in their eye. That's a real thing?
Yeah. I mean, he had this... When you just look at him, he just looks back at you like, I'm not afraid of nobody. I am the man, and that's it. And I'm going to do what I'm bred to do.
How about New York Traffic? When you looked at him a couple of years ago and saw him at that 2-year-old in training sale, here's a horse now that's earned over $500,000, nearly beat a horse that likely to be Horse of the Year, Authentic in the Haskell. He is as talented as they come. What struck you about him?
Just his size, too. I mean, he had good size to him. He was a little lighter framed than what Capo Kane is. But just the size of him and just the way he walked, he kind of strut like the same way Capo Kane does. And he was just a nice individual.
Yeah,
and we got him at the right
horse,
price,
though.
You know?
Yeah, it's a heck of a horse sale, too, that Mid-Atlantic 2-year-old in training sale. And, of course, Fasig Tipton, the longtime supporter of this show. So any chance we get an opportunity to work that in, we try to. But that's a sale that's been very, very good to you, Harry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you just got to get lucky. I mean, this game is a lot of luck. I mean, I've seen people buy horses for $1 million, $1.4 million, and they don't even run the first year as a 2-year-old, and they go as 3-year-olds, and some of them make it, and some of them you never see run. You just got to get lucky.
When did you first know that Capo Kane was the horse you thought he could be?
In his workouts, every time we breezed him, the faster he got, and then we started putting him in company, and he got very aggressive. Like his first workout, when I worked him 3/8 of a mile, I believe he went in 36-2 very comfortably with his head in his chest, and the rider come back and said, I have plenty more horse. So... I knew then that this horse is going to be something.
You know, a few minutes ago you mentioned the owners that have stuck by you over the years. Talk about some of the people that have helped you along the way and stood by you and said, yeah, Harry Weiner, we believe in you.
Well, John Finale is one of them with New York Traffic. He stuck by me, and I still train for him. He's really helped me. Tony Como, which is Bing Cherry Racing and Just In Time Racing here at Parks. He's got me a lot of horses, claims me a lot of horses. He went to a sale with me. This is his second time to the sale buying 2-year-olds. And we've been successful, obviously. And he stuck by me, and Leonard Liberto, too. I mean, they're just unbelievable people. I mean, we've been through our ups and downs, and now we're on our high.
You know, there's so many trainers I talk to on this program, and this show now dates back about 9 years or so. And I've had the privilege to talk to, you know, the top trainers in the game, and then some people that had only saddled one horse and just getting started with their careers. And the one thing that all trainers talk about is trying to develop a relationship with their owners, where it becomes more than just a client-trainer relationship. Is that important to you too, Harry?
Yes, we're good friends. We go out for lunch one time a week, and we get together, and, you know, I always see him every day at the races. We sit down, we have lunch, we talk about other things. And I think the main thing with owners is just being honest. I mean, sometimes you got to give them bad news, and that's what you got to do, but never lie to them. Just be honest.
Do you remember the...
And that's what I do.
Yeah, it's a great point, Harry. Do you remember the first time that you had to call a trainer with news and you were like, oh, this is not going to be good. I don't want to make this call.
I've done that a couple of times, yeah.
It's always that uneasy feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always like, how am I going to explain how this horse got hurt? Or, you know, I had one in the morning, I was breezing, and it took a bad step on the track, and it broke its leg, and we had to pull it down, and I had to call the owner and tell him, and actually the owner took it very well, but he took it better than I did. To be calling him.
Accidents
do happen, you know. It's part of racing. It's part of the training, and they do happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the part of the job when you talk to trainers in this particular profession. When you get into it, you know that at some point that's likely to happen, and nobody wants it to happen, certainly the trainer. And when it does, it's devastating for everybody involved. But you kind of know going in that that's one of the parts of this job that it's not pleasant, but it's there.
Correct. I mean, this job is a gamble. I mean, it is a gamble. You buy a horse, you're gambling on that horse to make you money, you know, to make money and to become a racehorse and hopefully win. I mean, it's a gamble.
What's the best thing about being a horse trainer?
I like the excitement. I like developing two-year-olds, especially seeing them come along, teaching them, and getting them to the first race, and hopefully carrying on with them. It's just the excitement, and I think just the thrill of winning races.
If you had to sum up your training philosophy and your approach to getting a horse ready, Harry, how do you do it?
Well, I train every horse different. I mean, I've worked for a lot of big trainers, and they seem to train each horse the same way. Every horse has its own personality. I mean, some horses want to jog the one way, 1 mile, and they run good off that. Some horses want to jog 2 miles. Some horses want to gallop 1.5 miles. Some horses will gallop 2 miles, and they run good. You just got to find a happy medium with them and train them to what the horse's ability is.
How long does it usually take you to figure out what's going to work for each individual horse?
Getting on them every day and just feeling them out and just trying different things with them and seeing what they like.
Yeah, there are
it's
other
hard
trainers
to tell how
that,
long it really takes.
Yeah, there are plenty of other trainers that started as jockeys, people like Wesley Ward, for example, and Wayne Catalano, or people that just jump to my head immediately now. But there are so many trainers that have started and then moved over to training horses. When you get on them in the morning, what are some of the things that you feel are, I guess I'll call it an advantage for you because you're getting to know that horse on a different level?
Well, the advantage for me getting on them is I can tell how they feel. I mean, if there's one has a little issue and I feel it, I can address it right away. And if one of my riders comes back and says, hey, boss, this horse didn't feel 100% today. I felt a little something in his left front or behind. I'll go, okay, I'll get on it tomorrow and see if I feel the same thing. And if I don't, I may feel something different. It's always good to get different information on one. And I think that's the advantage of me getting on them.
Yeah, it's a great advantage. And it makes sense that you can work with, you know, the other exercise riders who are with you and compare notes, which I think is a huge advantage. Plus, when you bring a horse over in the afternoon and you start talking, for example, to a guy like Dylan Davis, who was aboard Cap O'Kane, you talk to them before the race, you have intimate knowledge of what works with that horse from a rider's perspective. How big is that?
Oh, that's very big. I mean, if a horse wants to lug in the morning or lugs out or anything, I can change the equipment so he doesn't do that. Or I can tell the rider, say, hey, this horse doesn't like dirt in his face, watch out for this. Or this horse wants to be on the lead, put him on the lead. He gets brave on the lead. Don't let him get behind and get headed, because he's a little, you know, sometimes horses like that we call chicken, you know. They don't want to run by other horses, so you put them on the lead and the heart gets big. So it's a big advantage to tell the rider exactly what you think.
Have you ever had a horse fool you where you're on them in the morning and you're thinking, boy, I'm not feeling it with this horse. I don't know if he has what it takes to be, you know, a top class or a decent racehorse. And then all of a sudden something happens and the horse just turns it on in the afternoons and really surprises you. Have you had that happen?
Yeah, most definitely. I had a horse a couple of years ago. I can't remember its name, but it was claimed off me. And I work it in the morning, and this horse would work half a mile in 53, even in company. And I think it was Tony's horse at the time, and I called him and said, Tony, I said, I know we paid, I think it was at the time we paid $20,000 for him. We claimed him. I said, this horse can't run. I got to drop him in for 10, Tony. I said, I'm sorry, I think we made a bad claim. And then when I put him in the race, he went wide to wire and won. So it was amazing, you know?
It's incredible. This game is full of stories like that. Talking with Harry Weiner, trainer of Capo Cane, winner of last week's Jerome at Aqueduct. He is on the Kentucky Derby trail. If you're just tuning into the show now, that was a huge effort from Capo Cane, winning by more than 6 lengths this past week, and bigger things ahead as he starts to make his way down the road to the first Saturday in May. Harry, when you think about some of the other horses that you've been around, you've made a living and really worked your tail off in the claiming game to get good horses, increase the number of horses in your stable, and hopefully train them up where they can start running at higher levels. Tell me about the challenges that presents, running an operation like that.
Well, it's a challenge every day. You know, I mean, my owners, they don't have a ton of money. I mean, we claim anywhere from $5,000 claiming horses to $20,000 claiming horses. So it's a challenge every day. It's tough. I mean, you have to work your tail off. You got to have good help on the ground is always good. That work hard on the horses. I mean, it takes a lot of time and just work. I mean, it's just very tough.
Before you get ready to claim a horse, how much homework do you put into that horse?
Oh, before I get to claim a horse, I'll watch, like, his last four races. I'll pull him off and watch him and see if he looks like he's moving good down the lane, or if he's showing in stride or anything like that, or he gets in or gets out, and try and see if there's anywhere that I can improve that horse before I take it. And then I go and look at him in the paddock, and if he looks good, I'll take him. Sometimes you can improve off certain trainers, sometimes you can't. You just got to – it's just a gamble when you claim.
What's been – would you consider to be the best claim that you've ever made?
Best claim I ever made was a horse called Billy One Light. And a horse called Winner Ride. Winner Ride went on and made, I believe he made $393,000 for me. And then the other horse was called Billy One Light, which I ran in a Don Levine Stakes. He finished fourth in there. He made over $300,000 for me. Those
Wow.
were the two best claims I did.
Yeah, those are spectacular claims. And I can imagine the owners had to be thrilled with that return on their investment.
Oh, yeah, they were very thrilled. Winner Ride, we claimed for $10,000, and he went on and made, I think he made over like $393,000.
Wow. What was the key to getting him to that level?
He was just when I claimed him, he was very skinny. He looked, so I had to mend his ulcers and inside him, put him on some medicine for that. And when I did that, he started to eat everything. He was well bred. He was by Candy Ride, who was a big 17 hand horse. And once he started eating, he put weight on, and he must have put 1,000 pounds on with me, and he just filled into himself, and he just started running.
Nah, it's incredible. And we see this all the time where horses will be claimed, and they'll be moved up to higher levels and have success at higher levels. It's not necessarily a reflection on the person you claim the horse from. It could be, but it's usually not. It's just a fact that they get a change of scenery. It's kind of like, I've always said it like this, Harry, and tell me if I'm way off base. It's kind of like an athlete who moves from one team to another, and he didn't have a lot of luck on one team, goes to another team, a different city, a different philosophy, a different organization, and they flourish. Is it like that with horses too?
Yeah, I mean, you can claim some horses and find little things wrong with them. You know, they come in, they just don't look good. The coat doesn't look good, they're sulking, and you just fix one thing on them, and then they just rebound, and it's just like a different atmosphere, and they just get happy. A happy horse will always run.
Well, that's one thing that my former co-host here on the program, Jude Feld, always said, you know, keep them happy. And that's when you get them to a point where they're fit, you just have to keep them happy. Is that sometimes difficult to do, though, Harry? Easier said than done?
It's easier said than done, yeah. You know, what I try and do, especially with fillies, they don't take a lot of training. So you try and do light with them, like jog them 2 miles the wrong way, especially claiming horses. That, you know, old-time horses, a seven-year-old, they already know how to run, and they're already fit. You know, so you just keep them happy, just jog them, play with them, and let them buck, let them squeal, and just let them be a horse. And I find out they run that way.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Harry Weiner here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Harry, we're down to about 2 minutes before I have to get to this break at the bottom of the hour. This first half of the show has really flown by. Second half, we'll talk more about your background. We'll go back to the beginning and talk about how you got started growing up in England, and we'll take it from there. But you essentially went out on your own, started saddling horses on your own in about 2011. And that year, you saddled 10 winners, which was tremendous because I think, according to Equibase, you only had about 64 starters, so it was a great win percentage. The next year, you come back with 10, then it's 15 and 10, and then all of a sudden in 2015, your numbers go up to 24 winners and 26 and then 20 and 24 and then 33 in 2019, 31 last year. What's been the key to keeping this thing moving and the arrow pointing upward?
Well, the key is changing your stock, especially with claiming horses. You don't want to hold on to them too long. You want to win with them and hopefully try and get them claimed and just keep rotating your stock, claim more horses. And I have the owners now that, you know, that are claiming owners, so they do that for me. So there's always new horses in the barn, and that's how you keep your percentage up.
Is that the biggest lesson you've had to learn?
Yes, because I used to run horses over their heads because I didn't want to lose them. I used to protect them. And then once I got the owners that I knew that would replace them, I changed my philosophy.
Well, the new philosophy is working. As we told you, the arrow definitely pointed upward, and now Harry has his first stakes winner to his credit with Capo Kane winning the Jerome. Going to get to a short break. When I come back, we'll talk to Harry about his life growing up in England. We'll talk about some of the people he worked with and his riding career. That's all in the second half of the show. Stay with me. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The heat is on in February at Fasig Tipton. Fasig Tipton is still accepting entries for the 2021 Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale, the last breeding stock sale of the season. In 2020, the sale produced scorching results with a $575,000 sale-topping broodmare prospect, a $310,000 in-foal broodmare, and a $265,000 short yearling. Enter now for the Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale to be held February 8th and 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be? Introducing racing's newest partnership experience, the Horse and Julep Racing Club. Come see what makes us so different. The inaugural partnership club is forming right now and will purchase yearlings at the Keeneland January sale under the eye of rising star agent Phil Hager. The horses will go to historic Darby Dan Farm, whose land has raised no fewer than 6 Kentucky Derby winners. Partners should plan for a meetup there to visit the farm, the horses, and the best of the bluegrass. Visit horseandjulep.club today to reserve your spot. Horseandjulep.club.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Phasic Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Phasic Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They're coming down to the corner pole. Capo Kane, he's been there from the start. Dylan Davis took a peek back to see that Swill's under a ride. Eagle Orb is coming three wide as the field makes their way down to the eighth pole. It's still Capo Kane. He's trying to take him gate to wire in the Jerome, and he's opened up a two-length lead now. Capo Kane, he wanders to the middle of the track past the 16th pole, but he's three lengths in front of Eagle Orb and comes down to the line. A five-length winner of the Jerome, Capo Kane over Eagle Orb. It got tight for third. Final time for the mile was 1:38 flat.
That's our very own, the Big A, Anthony Stabile, with the call of last week's Jerome, and Capo Kane getting the victory for trainer Harry Weiner, who is my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Welcome back, all aboard the Kane train, as they like to say now, as he is on his way toward the Kentucky Derby on the first Saturday in May, and a lot of work to do in between now and then, but certainly a talented prospect. And if you're just joining us, we had a chance to look back on that victory in the first half of the show. Coming up in the second half, I will talk to Harry about the very beginnings. He grew up in England. He rode steeplechase horses, came to the United States in 1989. We'll talk about that coming up here momentarily. If you did miss any portion of the show, all you have to do is head over to our website, horseracingradio.net, to check out the podcast. You can do that at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. One quick announcement from Churchill Downs. This announcement pertains to all horsemen regarding this year's Triple Crown. Remember that Triple Crown nominations will open on January 11th. The first closing is Saturday, January 23rd, and a payment of $600 must accompany the nomination at that point. All you have to do is go to thetriplecrown.com to nominate online with a credit card, or you can call Kelly Danner at Churchill Downs. Her number is 502-639-3825. But the easiest and fastest way to do it is through thetriplecrown.com. The second closing for Triple Crown noms is March 29th, but that's going to cost you $6,000 on that date if you wait. So it's best to nominate early. Do it now, thetriplecrown.com. Nominations open January 11th. The first closing is January 23rd. And head over there right now and get that done. Harry, have you done that already?
Yes, we have. He's already nominated.
Yeah, smart man. I can imagine that was already done. Hey, you told me during the commercial break, and I had to use it coming back, that Kane Train has really kind of caught on, all aboard the Kane Train. I think we're going to hear a lot of that as we move over the next few weeks and the next couple of months.
Yes, I've seen it all over the internet, and I kind of find it very amusing, really. It's amazing what people come up with.
Yeah, incredible. It's very catchy, and I think a lot of people are going to be saying that. We heard that call, and that's Anthony Stabile, who works with us here on the network, hosts a lot of our programming throughout the week. How many times have you gone back and watched the replay of that race, Harry?
Oh, I watch it every night. My wife, it's kinda like my wife's fed up of watching it. She's like, "You're putting that on again?" I go, "Yep."
Hey, why not? You get the right to watch that as much as you want to. It's kind of like a lullaby for you, right, before you go to bed.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, it was certainly spectacular. Let's go back to the beginning here, Harry. I mentioned you're born in England, rode steeplechase races. Take me back to the very beginning, though, the young Harry Weiner growing up. Were you always interested in horses as a kid?
It's kind of funny, really, because none of my family liked horses. My mother, my father, they all hate horses. But my great-great-grandfather was a jockey back in the day from what when I went back and did research. So when I was like 4 years old, we had a riding school near me in Hilton Park, it was called. And I went over there and I got on this little Shetland pony. I'll never forget it. It was like 30 years old. His name was Joey. And he ran off with me across the field and got down and rolled over the top of me. And I got up and I started laughing. And from then, I just said, this was great. I guess I was a crazy kid back then. And I went to riding lessons. And when I was 10 years old, I was teaching people how to ride horses. They said I was very...
Wow.
My teacher couldn't believe how much I learned. I was just a natural, she said.
Were you at all, you got rolled over with Joey, the Shetland pony. Were you at all like nervous to get back on a horse after that, or were you just gung-ho and said, let's do this again?
I was just gung-ho. I jumped right back on him, kicked him in his belly, his head, and off I went.
I think you were destined to be a steeplechase rider.
Probably. So
you're 10 years old,
then, like
you're giving people riding lessons at the age of 10. Did you know at that point, look, I don't know what else is out there, but I just want to be around horses?
Yeah, I just knew then. I used to, in England, when we went to school, I walked to school because the school was right down the road from my house, and I used to take an extra set of clothes and leave to go to school, change into my stable clothes and go to the stables instead of going to school. I used to skip school, and then my mother would get letters that I didn't show up for school, and then my sister had to write a letter back saying I was sick. She used to get me out of it all the time.
Yeah, you had the bug pretty bad, Harry.
Yeah, I had it bad. I just loved horses.
Was there ever a point as you were growing up that you said, okay, maybe I'll end up doing something else, or was this it for you?
No, it was never a point. I always wanted to be with the horses.
What happened after high school?
After high school, I got lucky because I was a pretty bad kid in school. I finished my exams, and my headmaster, who was in charge of the school, his brother was a horse trainer at the time called W.A. Stevenson, who was one of the biggest steeplechase trainers, and he took a liking to me. And he got me... After I left school, he got me a job with his brother, W.A. Stevenson, at the time in Bishop Auckland. And when you go there, I groomed six horses, and they were my horses. I had to ride them. I groomed them. I did everything with those horses. They were like kids to me. Nobody else touched them but me. I took them to the races, everything. And that's how I learned with racehorses.
The first time that you got a leg up in a jump race?
Yes. Actually, the first racehorse I galloped, we go out in sets of like 60, 70 horses at one time over there. And I was like, I don't know, I was at the back of the pack. I was on a horse called Shiny Sun. It was a big 3-mile chaser. And my boss, W.A. Stevenson, said to me, just gallop easy. And I ended up getting run off with, and I flew by everybody. And everybody was laughing at me. But that's how I learned. I mean, I stayed on that horse until I learned how to gallop him. And then he put me on a tougher one, and that's how you learn.
You know, I have a good friend of mine, Sean Clancy, who rode steeplechase races for a long time. He's worked with me here on the network, and we've just become very close. And I always asked him when we first started talking, why on earth would anybody want to ride in a steeplechase race? Because to me, from the outside looking in, it just looks so incredibly dangerous. And I think, you know, no offense, but you have to have a couple screws loose in order to do this, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the thrill. It's just the excitement and the thrill if you're going into a jump at 30 miles an hour. It's a feeling that's hard to describe if you've never done it.
What about the first actual race that you rode in?
The first actual race I rode in was a horse called African Opera, and it was for Michael Dickinson, and he told me to... When the line goes up to lay second or third, going into the first hurdle, and obviously the horse ran off. I was 15 in front of the field going into the first hurdle. My eyes were bigger than anything. I was trying to rear the horse back, and I couldn't. So I just dropped my hands, and he just went over the jump. I was terrified.
I can imagine how scary that must have been. Did he get around there okay?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We got around there. I think I finished third that day. And he yelled at me the whole way back because I didn't come from behind like he wanted me to. But
how do
he ran
you,
off of
okay,
me.
As somebody who is, again, from the outside looking in here, and I've ridden a horse twice in my life, and Harriet scared the hell out of me both times. There were trail rides. I didn't like it one bit. But if you were to tell me, if you were to try to teach me how to ride, mm-hmm. and how, in particular, how to ride a steeplechase race, and how to make a horse jump before they go over the fence, what's the key?
Well, the thing we do, jumping, you know, we get a lot of flat horses. Even over here, the flat horses make jumpers. They start them out on trotting poles, which is like three poles you put on the ground, and then you jog them at very slow jog over them, so they learn to go over the poles. And then you start with a cavalletti, which is maybe an inch and a half, and then you go into it real slow, and then automatically they just bounce over it. And then once they start to learn that, you start putting the jumps higher, and that's how they learn.
What's the highest jump that you ever had to go over?
When I was show jumping, I used to do Jim Carners back when I was 12, 13 years old. I mean, the highest one I ever went over was like 5'5", 5'6".
Wow. Wow. Better you than me, my friend. He is trainer Harry Weider.
You should try it. You'll like it. You'll probably like it.
I have to master the trail ride thing first. You know, we did one, and we actually did one where we went into the ocean. You went bareback on the horse in the ocean. You let them swim, and that was cool. Mm-hmm. But man, I was holding on for dear life. I have to learn to get a little more comfortable when I'm aboard a horse.
Yeah, you got to relax. That just comes with time.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. Harry Weiner here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. So, you're working with WA Stevenson and you're riding steeplechase races. Tell me about where it goes from there. Where does the journey take you?
Well, I left WA Stevenson and I went to work for Michael Dickinson in Harewood, and doing the same thing, grooming horses, being exercising them and everything. And I rode a couple of races for him, and then my mother moved to America at the time. She lived in Boston, and Michael was on about moving his stable to America. So I said it would be a good idea for me to come over and see my mother, and when Michael moved to America, I'll be here, then I'll go and work for him at Fair Hill, which I did. And that's how I got to be in America.
You said earlier that your mother and your family really had no interest in horses whatsoever. What did they think about you choosing this as a profession?
My mother said I was crazy. She said, it must have been when she dropped me on my head when I was born. That gave me no brain, she said.
It was.
Absolutely crazy.
It was a match made in heaven then, because if she thought you were crazy, you started working with Michael Dickinson, who became known as the Mad Genius because of the work he did.
Oh, he's crazy.
He's crazy.
Very tough to work for.
Yeah. Okay, what was it like working with him?
It was just very tough. I mean, Michael is very meticulous. Everything has to be 110 perfection. If you had one little thing out of place, he would scream at you, but I understand why, because he's a very good horsemanship, and he likes everything to be clean, sparkless, which it should be, and he was just very meticulous.
Well, it seems like a lot of the really top trainers in the game are like that. You think about a guy like Dwayne Lucas, and everything in his barn has always been meticulous, and
correct.
You know, he's a former basketball coach. Everything had to be just so. Are there things
correct.
that Harry you've taken from Michael Dickinson that you're using today, even if it's on a small scale?
Yeah, I use, like, with Capo Kane, he's getting ready to go further, so you train him further. Michael used to train a lot of horses, like steeplechase horses, long, slow, easy gallops. Put wind into them. That's what we call putting air into them. And when you breeze them nice and easy, setting off, and then let them finish through the lane. Teach them how to pick up speed as you go along, because a race is won. You know, it's not won down the backside, it's run down the stretch. So I like to teach all my horses to run from around the middle of the turn to the wire every day, down the back, have them off a bridle so they're not pulling you. And as soon as they hit the middle of the turn, turning for home, they know they've got to jump on that bridle and go. And that's the way Michael trained, and it helps me a lot.
Yeah, I mentioned his nickname, the Mad Genius. Why do you think he got that nickname?
The Mad Genius, because he come up with these crazy ideas, but they all seem to work.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that he did that everybody probably would never have done, especially training horses and the way he did stuff. It was just, you wouldn't think you would do it, but it worked. It worked for him.
Do you remember something he did that was a little off the wall and unconventional, and it for whatever reason, it, like you said, it worked?
Yeah, I mean, he would, like, send you out, like at Fairhill, you could go out in the woods, and you'd go, there was a place up there that had a real steep gallop, so you'd gallop uphill, and he would send the horse out there and tell you to go on a 3-mile hike and then gallop him up this hill. And we'll be looking at him like, that's crazy. Why not just go to the track and gallop him? But, you know, but he liked to go through the woods and everything else like that.
When did you stop working with Michael and start shifting your focus to other things?
I started working with Michael, come over and worked for him, 89. I worked for him for like a year, and then I met a young lady, and I got married. It was my first wife. And then we moved to Delaware Park, and I started galloping horses for Sam Cronk and different people over there in the morning as an exercise rider. Because I said this was great. I was getting paid, I think, $7 at the time to get on the horse, and I was making more money doing that than I was being a groom and galloping for Michael. So it was a matter of just making more money. And then I got to meet Arabian trainer called Billy Lewis that said to me, if I got my weight down, he'll let me ride this Arabian that I was getting on every day. And I thought to myself, well, I've never rode a flat race. I said, let me see if I can do it. And I got my weight down. It took me a year to get my weight down to 115, and then I rode my first flat race.
Okay, so what were you at before you got to 115?
I was at 140.
Wow, that's quite a drop. How did you do it?
A lot of exercise and eating salads and just running every day. It would be 80 degrees out, and I'd be in a plastic suit with a bunch of clothes on, running down the road. Everybody thought I was crazy. And it's just hard work, just exercising and running and just watching what I eat.
The big challenge. You know, I actually, as I was reading about your riding career, I went back and looked up some of the statistics and all that kind of stuff when I was getting ready for the show, and I noticed that with the flat races, the thoroughbreds, you rode 462 races. You ended up winning 14. But with the Arabians, you rode 95 races, and you won 7 of those 95. So the win percentage with Arabians was even higher than the thoroughbreds. How come? Why were the Arabians so good to you?
I had a real good Arabian called Flash Magic. He was real nice to ride. He kind of ran like a steeplechase horse. He would come from way out of it, you know, going long, a mile and an eighth. He would be sitting 20 lengths back, and those are the type of horses I like. Because at home in England, I wasn't used to the way these jockeys ride here on a flat. You know, you break and go. It was all speed. Back home in England, obviously, when we break out the gate on the flats, you see, we don't go as fast as you guys early. We finish stronger. And it was just my style of riding. I wasn't very good out the gate because I wasn't used to that hustling like all these jockeys are over here. And obviously I was weak too, you know, from losing weight all the time.
Yeah, you rode from 90 to 92 and then went back to the training side of things. What made you realize that, okay, I'm not going to be in the Hall of Fame as a jockey?
Well, my last ride in Maryland, I was on a horse and I passed out at the half-mile pole. I don't even remember because I had taken like 4 cc's of Lasix. I lost like 9 pounds that day to ride the horse.
Whoa.
And I passed out at the half-mile pole, and Mike Luzzi saved me, actually. He kept his horse next to my horse and kept me in until the outrider got me. From what I heard, I woke up in the hospital the next day. So that was the end of it.
Yeah, well, thankfully you weren't hurt worse than you actually were. That's a scary thing. And at that point, you said, okay, I'm done riding. I've got to stay in horse racing. Is that when you went to work for Mark Henning?
Yeah, well, actually, I was with a trainer called Terry Hewitt after that. I rode some horses for him, too, with Mr. Hoover, and he moved to New York, so I went with him, and I galloped for him and everything, and then he was leaving New York to go back to South Carolina for the winter, and that's when I got the assistant job with Mark Henning.
What was it like working with Mark after being around guys like Michael Dickinson?
Oh, it was a dream. Mark was great to work for. Great to work for. He would come in the morning, never yell, just very calm. You know, everybody knew what to do there. You know, we all did our work. He would say, Harry, this is what I want you to do, and I'd make sure he got done.
Isn't that incredible, Harry? You have so many different approaches and styles and ways of doing this job. And when I say this job, I mean training horses. And you obviously have your own style that you talked about earlier. But everybody comes at it from a different angle. There's no one set way to do this job. And it works. It worked for Michael Dickinson. It works for Mark Henning. It worked for Dwayne Lucas, Nick Zito. Everybody has their own approach. And they're a little bit different, but they all work.
Correct. I mean, you just got to, you know, it's what works for that individual. And you got to have good help in the barn, too. You have good help in the barn, and you put yourself around good people. It makes life easier.
You were around some really good horses when you were working with Mark, too. Tell me about some of those horses. And I'll ask you the second part of this question in a minute, but tell me about some of the horses you were around when you were working with Mark.
I was around Raging Fever. That was a very nice filly. Gold Mover, that beat Extra Heat down at Calder that year. Seeking Daylight. Summer Colony, that won the big race in California. Who else did we have? Drama Acrylic, that was a very big horse on the turf. Mark had a lot of nice horses then.
Yeah, I read a story about you being around one of, Gaija Star?
Yeah, Gigi Star. Yeah, Gigi Star.
Gigi
yep.
Star.
That was another one of Mark Henning's that was going for the Breeders' Cup, and Pat Day won on him at Belmont, a stake. Yeah, that was a very nice horse, too.
Is there something, Harry, as you now, with Capo Cane, begin to start looking toward some of the Triple Crown, the other Triple Crown prep races, is there something to be said for that experience that you've gained around horses like that that can help you?
Oh, yeah, most definite. I mean, a good horse trains himself. I've always said that. I mean, we're just a pilot on him. Like with Gigi Star, he would go out there and gallop probably at 16 seconds to an eighth and just nice and easy. All you did was sit chilly. And when he breezed his way. I mean, he would breeze quick. That was him. And the same with Capo Cane. He trains himself.
Yeah, pretty special horse. How much time did you spend with Mark before going out on your own?
I was with Mark for, I believe, 3 years, and then I moved to James Bond, 007.
Okay.
And I was with him for 2 years, and then I went out on my own.
Yeah, I'd imagine James Bond, a whole different approach to training horses than Mark Henning, or were they somewhat similar?
Yeah. More or less the same, but it's... some things were different over there.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting stuff. How did you know the time was right to go out on your own, Harry?
I didn't. I just did it.
I said, I'm going to do it?
I just got up one day and I said, I want to... I got offered a couple of horses and I said, okay, let's try it. I thought, if it didn't work, I could always go back to being an assistant for somebody.
That's a great point. Were the first couple of years a little nerve-wracking and challenging?
Yeah, it was very challenging. It was very challenging. I only had a couple of horses, and I did get to meet the one trainer from Woodbine named Scott Fairley, He trains at Woodbine, and he would leave horses here with trainers in the wintertime because he went back to Woodbine and, you know, and just left his horses here and ran him in their name, and that's what he did for me. He left me with 10 or 12 horses, and that kind of boosted me along because I won races, and then people saw that, and then they gave me horses.
How many horses do you have now?
I have 24 now.
Wow, what a ride. What a journey this has been, starting in England and being aboard a Shetland pony named Joey and getting rolled over and then ending up here on the Kentucky Derby Trail. It is pretty special, Harry, and really excited for you. I'm down to about the final 3 minutes of the program. This has been such an enjoyable hour. I think we could spend another hour together. But I want to ask you this question, then I'm going to ask you kind of my standard question that we usually wrap up the show with. But what do you think when you think about everything you've been through, everything you've overcome, all of the different things that you've gone through in your career, what do you think you're most proud of to this point, Harry?
I'm proud of where I've come from. I started this stable with 2 horses, and now I'm up to 24. I only had 1 owner. Now I've got a couple of owners. Obviously, I'm looking for more owners. Hopefully I can improve my stock. I'm just happy with everything that's happened, and I've overcome a lot. I mean, I've had a lot of people say I'd never make it. I'm doing this wrong, I'm doing that wrong. And I just tell everybody it's a dream, you know. If you really want it, you can do it. You just got to work. It's just hard work.
What do you think you would be doing if you weren't training racehorses?
I'll probably be in jail.
By far the best answer I've ever gotten to that question. Well, thank goodness you are training racehorses. Harry, are there other things you enjoy doing outside of racing, other, I don't know, sports or hobbies? Or
in my pastime, I like to play pool. I play on the Amateur Pool Association on Wednesdays and Thursdays. And I like to go for a walk. I take my dog for a walk and just relax and just do different things.
Yeah, a great way to kind of relax and reset and get ready for what's going to be a very busy couple of months. He's trainer Harry Weiner here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Harry, listen, been a delight to hear your story and can't thank you enough for taking the time. All the best with Capo Kane and your entire stable, and all the best along this road to the Kentucky Derby. I hope I'm calling you again when we get to Churchill to ask you to come back on and talk a little bit more about the big horse.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
All right, Harry Weiner here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. If you missed any portion of the show, really simple. Head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this show and all of our shows. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. What a visit. Hey, Harry, what do you think you'd be doing if you weren't training racehorses? Well, I'd probably be in jail. Best answer ever to that question. My thanks to Harry for taking the time. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, and my thanks to everybody for tuning in to Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton here today. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next week.